Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Last month, Nikki Green was among many Wellesley residents who saw screenshots of a series of Facebook messages between some Wellesley high school students. Now, those Facebook messages included vitriolic and hateful language directed at African Americans and immigrants with jokes about lynching and genocide. The incident stunned much of the Wellesley community, and Green, too, was shocked. But she wasn't entirely surprised. In fact, the incident brought to mind something else that happened to her back in 2011, a moment that first raised her awareness of the challenges of raising her African-American children in a community like Wellesley. Green is an assistant professor of art history at Wellesley College and a contributor to WBUR's Ideas and Opinion page, Cognoscenti. And that's where she first shared her story, but she joins us now. She happens to be in Tampa, Florida today. Nikki Green, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We were really taken by your story and your column on Cognoscenti, and we wanted to invite you here to sort of share it with us once again, and we want to dig in a little deeper. So for people who haven't read it, can you just take us back to 2011 and tell us a little bit about what happened to you and your family?
Sure. So I arrived in Wellesley August of 2011. And so by September, I was settling into a routine and I joined a colleague and her two children for a stroll through town, the center of town. And we decided to get ice cream with our children. And we were sitting outside on a single bench and eating our ice cream very innocently. A woman came, approached us, as happens occasionally when you have cute children. started playing with one of the baby's feet. And my daughter, I was sitting on the bench and my daughter was standing looking at me. And the woman is an older woman. She then said, "Oh, I want to see her face." And my daughter didn't respond. She's eating her ice cream. She's looking at her mother. And when she didn't respond, she repeated herself. She put her hand on top of her head. She was four at the time. She put her hand on top of her head and turned her head so that it would pivot to look behind her, to look into her face.
So the woman put her hand on your daughter's head.
The woman put her hand on my daughter's head and turned her head physically to make sure that she could see her face straight on. So I was shocked, and my friend who was with me was also shocked. And you know, she said, I don't remember the rest of the conversation because I was so taken aback by that. She eventually walked away after a few seconds and we looked at each other, and I turned to her and I said, "Oh my God, when did we become the petting zoo?" Because I hadn't ever had something that drastic happen before. And I know for some people who have read the story, they think, "Oh, no, that's just something people do when they see cute children." Mm-hmm. And there's something particularly different about being a group of African American people, two families, sitting in a predominantly white town and having someone approach you and do that same act. It's absolutely different.
Yeah. So tell me more about that, because I mean, I'm hearing this as a woman and a mother myself. And first of all, there's just the sheer audacity of someone touching your child without your permission.
Right, exactly.
But second of all, I'd love to hear more from you about why at that moment, again, you said it's just different for you being, you know, a person of color in a predominantly white town. Why did it feel distinctly different?
It was different because in one respect, I should mention, I've lived in predominantly white towns before. I went to boarding school. I'm used to being in these kinds of spaces, right? So it was different because I think in hindsight, and I recorded this instance of this ice cream incident to myself 4 years ago. I wrote this story down because I wanted to hold on to it. It was different because in hindsight, I realized that as I've lived there for the last 5 years, that it is unusual, actually, to see, you know, six African-Americans in the main street. So that kind of the way in which Black bodies, in particular, people of color, stand out in the town of Wellesley, I understand now that it was unusual. And so I think the kind of privilege, the kind of white privilege that's been given historically for people to have that sense of entitlement to touch, to manipulate, to even if they think that it's innocent, it is a form of microaggression. This idea that you can have these small acts that don't seem like a big deal, but that over time you realize you've crossed a boundary. This woman crossed a boundary at a certain point. And so I am, you know, I'm speaking as a mother, I'm speaking as a scholar, and I'm also speaking as an African-American woman. Mm-hmm. I teach race, and I actually have a seminar called The Body, Race, and Gender in Modern and Contemporary Art, because I'm clearly aware of these, the way in which systems over time and the history in this country of Black bodies entering these spaces, that there's always going to be a line that's crossed, yeah, especially when you don't know the person.
You know, I'm fully cognizant that we are having this conversation in a country much of whose history is founded on white ownership of Black bodies, right?
Exactly.
So
right.
I'm cognizant of that as an important part background to this conversation. But when you talked about microaggressions, I'm wondering, when it comes to the white person crossing that line through a microaggression, if the intent isn't, you know, in 2011 or 2016, you know, in modern times, if the intent isn't one of active conscious racism, should
right.
we really be calling it an aggression, micro or otherwise?
Yes. Just because someone acts in ignorance doesn't make it excusable. And I think it's a process of education that's required so that even if the offender doesn't know that they're perpetuating a kind of act that can be seen as innocent, but over time, for those who are victimized by microaggressions, it can come across as quite violent. And I know that even saying that out loud may make people kind of shudder, that how is this innocent interaction, so-called innocent interaction, considered violent? The issue for me and for my children and for so many families in this country is that you can have an instance like that once and may think, oh, that's pretty innocent. But when you see a pattern form over time, how many times will my children be fondled before you say that it's no longer violent? If one person sees it as innocent, and then the 10th person comes around, and my daughter, who's now 9, how many times will she encounter that? At what point is there a limit where she can stake a claim in her own and sort of the ownership of her own body and say, no, you've crossed a line that shouldn't be crossed.
Yeah, you know, so the physical aspect of what happened is, it stands out. It does stand
right.
out to me. And I wanted to share with you for a second where I'm coming from, because,
sure.
You know, I myself am speaking to as a woman of color myself. And
right.
I grew up in a small town in Oregon that was predominantly white. It was like very much like Wellesley, actually.
Okay,
and no one ever really like reached out and grabbed my head, to be honest. But growing up, frequently, you know, people would say, you know, the whole, where are you from? How do you pronounce your name?
Where are you really from?
Yeah, where are you really from? Oh, and wow, you don't have an accent. Where did you learn English? All that kind of stuff. And my answers were, well, I'm from, you know, Oregon, and I don't have an accent because I'm an American, blah, 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 blah. And the point being is, like, those could also be classified as microaggressions. And especially I hear you when you say that the continual nature of it, like year after year, you know, decade after decade. But on the other hand, and again, I'm saying this knowing that, like, telling you, no one ever actually, like, crossed the line and touched me in a weird, uncomfortable way.
Right.
But when it comes to harm, I have to think to myself sometimes, and I question whether or not I was ever harmed by those questions and that those presumptions about who I am. And again, for me, Meghna, I don't necessarily think I was harmed, but it sounds like in your case, you're saying that, do you feel that, where does the sense of harm, does a sense of harm come in over time?
It's over time. Was my daughter traumatized by this incident? No. Does she even remember it? Of course not. The issue becomes that for so many, it's the recognition. I'm going to speak from the perspective of my kids. Mm-hmm. I want my kids to be self-possessed enough to know that they can recognize what's clearly what can be a very innocent question. My children are going to have questions about the color of their skin and the texture of their hair, and where are your parents from? My husband is actually an immigrant. He's originally from Trinidad. And they're going to have these questions posed. And I do think there is a respectful way to have those questions answered, and that we should all feel welcome to have, if you're curious about another culture or another person's background, it's sure you want that dialogue to happen. That is actually how we learn from each other. I think for me, and I'll bring this back to Wellesley, Massachusetts. I brought up that instance in the context of Wellesley because we had young people who are not, people who are not adults yet, adolescents, who are at a point where they feel as if it's perfectly fine to call people the N-word, even in jest among each other, to talk about genocide, about their classmates and the people in their community, regardless if they were bused in from the Medco program or if they live within this community, then there's something particularly upsetting about living in a town where you can have children be so self-possessed at already such an early age to believe that it's perfectly fine that you can joke like that within a group of friends and have no one check you. Mm-hmm. So why I originally wrote that post was because I felt like I needed to state that some small acts occur way before they enter high school. And or also thinking about who are the parents of these children, who are the grandparents of these children, and what kind of conversations are happening in the home that leads to this kind of racist conversation,
right? So
this kind of prejudice. It's one thing to innocently speak about finding out about someone's background, and I think that's healthy. It's healthy for in some respects for a child to be able to talk about where are you from, what's your background, and say that with pride. But when denigration becomes a part of the dialogue, I also want my children to understand that they have a right to stand up for themselves.
I hear you saying that it's maybe fewer steps than we think from mm-hmm. an innocent, quote-unquote innocent interaction to setting an example that leads to the kind of racist language that was on those Wellesley High School Facebook posts.
Exactly.
Well, we've just got a couple seconds left. I mean, that's a sobering thought, and I'm grateful for you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. We just really have just about a minute to go here, Professor
sure.
Green. Can I ask how your kids are doing? I mean, how has spending the last 5 years as members of the Wellesley community been for them?
Sure, they're fine. They are happy children. They have a great group of friends. Being a part of the Wellesley College community has been very empowering. They have great friends at the school. And I just recently talked with the principal and of their school in Wellesley. I'm very much looking forward to the new school year to have opportunities for the rest of the community to talk, especially parents, so that we can continue to think about how we can build community that is supportive, open-minded, open-hearted, and so that we can make some critical next steps as a community.
Well, Nikki Green is Assistant Professor of Art History at Wellesley College. She teaches and writes about race, feminism, and music in modern and contemporary art. She's also a contributor to Cognoscenti, WBUR's ideas and opinion page, and her most recent Cognoscenti column was titled Eating Ice Cream While Black. We have a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Green, thank you so much for coming on the program and for talking with me. I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And listeners, let us know what you think. Send us your comments at radioboston.org. You can always send us a tweet as well at Radio Boston. We'd love to know what you think. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.